This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the flu is everywhere these days. Center for Disease Control and Prevention confirmed that we are in the midst of the worst flu epidemic in a decade.
1 in 14 visits, according to the CDC, that were made to healthcare providers in the past month were due to the flu. 15,000 hospitalizations. But what we really are most saddened by is the lethality of this epidemic.
Close to 60 pediatric deaths reported from the flu. The young, the elderly, the medically compromised are the most susceptible to the illness.
You know, I'm not sure everybody realizes how many strains of the virus there are. This year, the culprit is the H3N2. According to the CDC, it's the strain most worrisome in terms of the toll it can exact. In this case, if you think you have the flu, contact your healthcare provider. There is antiviral medication that can make a huge difference.
In the meantime, there's a push in Washington for funding for the development of a universal flu vaccine.
The bill would actually provide $1 billion to support research, which is already underway in this area. Hopefully, people will remember this long after the epidemic has passed.
Our guest today is Dr. Steve Klasko, president and CEO of Thomas Jefferson University. He's on a mission to transform the healthcare system from the inside out. Really looking forward to hearing his ideas, Margaret.
And Lori Robertson will stop by. She's the managing editor of factcheck.org.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Steve Klasko in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Funding for community health centers, the latest political football in the budget fray in Washington. 27 million mostly vulnerable and low-income Americans receive their health care at some 1,400 community health center organizations around the country. But the funding was not renewed at the end of last September and has pushed many of the nation's health centers into financial limbo. The House has passed a bill continuing community health center funding for 2 years, but big changes are expected once the Senate gets a hold of it. Asthma affects some 6 million children in this country, but rates for African American children are much higher. Nearly 16% of all black kids in this country have the condition, which often requires daily inhalers and medication to keep the disease in check. An analysis of the demographics of asthma also shows that those who are poor are less likely to be able to afford their medication and often go without. And the House Science Committee is considering cutting off funds to the World Health Organization's Cancer Research Division, which released a report recently linking exposure to the weed killer Roundup to incidents of cancer. Congressman Lamar Smith admonishing the WHO for issuing those findings, which run counter to the EPA's ruling on the hotly contested subject. Monsanto's Roundup is the most widely distributed herbicide in the world. A number of countries have banned its use due to research showing a number of health hazards from exposure. Syphilis has been roaring back as antibiotic resistance continues to grow, and that has led to a bump in babies being born with the disease as well. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is issuing a new recommendation that all pregnant women in the U.S. be screened early in pregnancy for syphilis. Infants exposed in utero have a higher likelihood of a number of birth defects, premature birth, even death, if the mother is not treated. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Steven Klasko, president and CEO of the Thomas Jefferson University and Jefferson Health, a consortium of 13 hospitals and healthcare centers around Philadelphia. Dr. Klasko is author of several books, including We Can Fix Healthcare, The Future Is Now. He is the former dean of Drexel University's College of Medicine and of the Morsani College of Medicine at the University of South Florida, where he built the Center for Advanced Medical Learning and Simulation. He received his MBA from Wharton and earned his MD from Hahnemann University. Dr. Klasko, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks. And more important than any of that, I was smart enough to sign an 8-year contract with the Eagles before they won the
game. Well, you know, if we're talking with anybody in Philadelphia, we got to start with the game. That was just, speaking of transforming an image of a city, that was just the right bromide for it. on a quest to transform healthcare. You've quoted R. Buckminster Fuller saying, "You never change things by fighting the existing reality. Build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete." I wonder if you could talk to us about your model you've developed at Jefferson Health, built on four pillar foundations, and how you believe it will help make the existing system obsolete.
So when I got to Jefferson, we were a 194-year-old entity. And I said, what if we could do like a startup company? And that's what we did. So we created four pillars, academic and clinical, and innovation and philanthropy. And what we called it was the old math and the new math, the old math of academic clinical, the new math of innovation philanthropy. As you can imagine, didn't make the faculty thrilled, but it was a math equation. An academic medical center, it's NIH funding, that's not going up. And we used to be able to just charge 12% more tuition a year, and that gigs up. So at Jefferson, by making innovation as important as academic and clinical, so my head of innovation reports to me at the same level as the provost of my university and the head of our hospitals, and that led to an entire change in our vision to reimagining healthcare to create unparalleled value. And that's what led to things like telehealth as opposed to building new beds. John Scully always says, stop talking about telehealth. We don't talk about telebanking. We talk about healthcare with no address, getting Jefferson care out to where people are.
Well, Dr. Klaska, I want to think about the teamwork training system that you modeled when you were at the Center for Advanced Medical Learning. How have you built upon that model at Jefferson Health?
So one of the cool things about Jefferson is we were the first medical school in the country that thought seeing humans would be a good idea. We had the first Center for Interprofessional Education. My entire research life has been is the fact that we still accept medical students based on science GPA, MedCats, on organic chemistry grades, and somehow we're just amazed that doctors are more empathetic, communicative, and creative. We are training physicians to be better robots than the robots. I'm on IBM Watson Health Advisory Board, and we're not going to do a better job than the robots. So what we're doing here at Jefferson is from the first time that a medical student literally starts their studies, they are basically surrounded by nursing students and pharmacy students. So before we have a chance to teach them to be arrogant or, quote, give orders, they're learning to be a teammate. So what I hear from residency directors all over the country is that our students understand teamwork better. Think about this. We are the only discipline that requires extreme technical and teamwork competence that never checks your technical and teamwork competence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a pilot every 2 years. I have to get my competence checked. There's no surgeon in this country that's 62 years old that has had their competence checked within 30 years. So that has to change. So using simulation to create great teammates and to recognize that you're going to have to continue to get your technical and teamwork competence assessed like pilots or folks in nuclear power plants makes a lot of sense. And I think Jefferson's leading the way.
Speaking of leading the way, your book, We Can Fix Healthcare of the Future, is now really focuses in on 12 areas of disruption that will sort of move the needle forward. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners a little bit about these disruptors and how do you feel we can disrupt this system that's obviously ineffective and not elegant.
The book was based on a science fiction type thing that President Obama, before he left, said, gosh, let's get everybody together in the healthcare ecosystem and solve the problem. And we started off doing what we do really well, which is blaming everybody that wasn't us. Look at things that are very, very logical. One is around health inequities and the social determinants of health. We talk about it. Philadelphia has 6 academic medical centers, but we have the highest discrepancy in life expectancy of any city in the country. So, you know, I made a suggestion that all the CEOs of health systems in Philadelphia, that 50% of their incentive is based on how Philadelphia is doing, not how their hospital is doing. Because that would force us to talk to each other and actually start to solve those issues. Looking at everything you can do that you can't do in healthcare, right? So the day after Thanksgiving, where we used to have to go to the mall, you can be in your pajamas and doing all your holiday shopping. But if you have a stomach ache the day after Thanksgiving, you're getting on the phone, listening to 11 options that the doctor might be able to see you on Wednesday. So what we were starting really is a campaign that literally patients need to demand those disruptions. The great thing is at Jefferson, we're starting the process of doing that anyhow. So I have a follow-up book coming on March 1st called Bless This Mess, A Picture Story of Healthcare in America. Asterisk, this is not a children's story. It's scary.
Dr. Glasgow, you've noted, as we have long noted, that creativity and curiosity and empathy are hugely important characteristics of people on our healthcare teams. And you, I understand, have made some real changes to your screening and acceptance process when you look for students. I'd be really curious how you see these traits of creativity and curiosity playing out in your vision of healthcare in the 21st century. And how we think about training health professionals past the screening of the candidates.
I got a very large grant to look at what makes physicians different than normal people. And what we came up with is the way we select and educate physicians, we've joined a cult around four biases: autonomy bias, a competitive bias, a hierarchy bias, and in some respects a non-creativity bias. When you ask business people or entrepreneurs what are the three skill sets that got them to where they are, creativity was number one, two, or three in just about all of them. Very rarely was it number one, two, or three with doctors. So if the world is changing and you're an autonomous, competitive, hierarchical creature, you don't want that change. So it is asinine, I believe, that gating mechanism to become a doctor is organic chemistry. You know, I'm an obstetrician. I've delivered 2,000 babies. And there's no human brain that will be able to memorize every genome when I have a baby that's got an anomaly. But 100% of the time when I deliver an unscheduled Down syndrome baby or anomaly, the patient asks, "Doctor, what does this mean?" The Google brain or the IBM Watson next to me will be absolutely great at taking a picture of that baby, going to its database and telling you what's wrong with it. It will never get the "what does it mean" means what does that mean to my image of a perfect baby. I think the American Association of Medical Colleges is at fault. You know, adding a few social determinants or a few emotional intelligence things to the MedCats is really spitting in the ocean. Think about this. You have to pass organic chemistry tests. And then between your second and third year, when you're finally going to see humans, you have to pass a multiple choice test. At what point do you say whether you can actually communicate with a human? You know, we just merged with a design university, and we started a program with Princeton University where we accept students in their design and engineering program after their first year at Princeton. We tell them to take the minimum amount of science courses, become great people, get really well-rounded, and they don't have to take the MedCats. There are people in Philadelphia that are spending $150,000 for their kids to get 6 Princeton reviews so they can memorize organic chemistry formulas and do great on the MedCats. Another kid with a battered Barron's book and won't do as well on the MedCats. And for that to be the sole determinant of whether or not you're going to be a good psychiatrist or go back to your community to be a family doctor is just ridiculous. So that whole screening mechanism needs to be disrupted in the age of AI and iPhones.
We're speaking today with Dr. Stephen Glasgow, President and CEO of the Thomas Jefferson University and Jefferson Health, a consortium of 13 hospitals and healthcare centers around Philadelphia with the largest faculty-based telehealth network in the country. We've been talking about technological advances that are going to sort of reshape the relationship maybe between clinicians and patients. And I'm wondering if you could share with us how you're leveraging technology to do that, sort of thinking back of how ineffective the design of the EHR has been. Is my portal Alexa and Siri? How will I be communicating so that wherever I am is the center of the universe versus wherever the doctor is?
You really bring up a great point, Mark. Part of the reason EMRs are not very patient or doctor friendly is because we weren't involved in their development because we didn't want to be. And I think, you know, we made a decision at Jefferson that we weren't just going to buy products off the shelf as related to telehealth, again, because it was about getting care out to where people are. If you have a mom or dad in a cancer center in this country, let's say you're in Denver and this cancer center is in Philadelphia, you're still calling your mom and saying, "Mom, what did the doctor say?" And she said, "I don't know. He or she came in at 5:30 in the morning with 6 young people, but I'm confused." We started something very simple, virtual rounds. When you come into Jefferson, basically say, "Who would you like to communicate with?" Send them software. We text them, we're making rounds. They're part of rounds. literally, I got to be an undercover boss in that. I had a surgery at Jefferson right before Father's Day. My kids were coming down from three different cities, and all they knew was that Dad had emergency surgery. 5 minutes after anesthesia, there are three iPads with my three children and the doctor telling them I'm going to be okay. Those are the kind of things that we can do with telehealth. Somebody calls our virtual triage now, we can send them to the ER at Jefferson. We can send them to an urgent care center, which is one block away. They'll get in and out, and it'll cost $50. We can get them an appointment the next morning at 7:30, or we can handle it at telehealth. What that does from an outcomes point of view, from an efficiency point of view, is very similar to what you've come to expect at a Target or a Walmart, that I can go to the store or I can get it done in an e-basis.
Well, Dr. Klasko, I think we agree this is a space that's ripe for innovation, something that we do see as a huge problem, and that is clinician burnout. You've noted increasing regulatory burdens and just the inefficiency of the care delivery system itself. And more importantly, you say you have some workable solutions to clinician burnout. So let's share those with our listeners.
You know, for a lot of physicians, it is a science fiction thing. They've basically entered a different planet than they started. If you're a private physician that was used to being autonomous, and now all of a sudden it's regulation, it's these huge systems, it's insurers telling you they're not going to contract with you, it's really scary, and frankly, you don't have the skill sets to solve it. So we did a study where we looked at medical staffs around the country, Margaret. You know, in most medical staffs, 20% of the docs just get it. 15% will never get it. They're just going to be angry no matter what. And then there's the 65%. Leaders spend 40% of their time with the folks that get it because we feel comfortable, and the least amount of time with the people that will change the culture. So we train the trainers at 20%, and then we don't have to spend as much time with them. We leave alone the 15%. We call that administrative hospice. And then we concentrate on a very, very innovative leadership academy with the 65% in the middle. They do internships so they can actually start to solve problems. And when you look at the physician burnout rate, folks through the leadership academy, it's literally one-fifth attitude-wise of the folks that haven't gone through. So the more people we can get to start to understand the changes and that they have control of those changes, I think we can start to affect the burnout. So telehealth is a great example. So when we started the telehealth thing, I went to every chair and said, none of you is going to get your incentives unless 80% of your faculty signs up and does at least one telehealth thing a month. And I thought I was going to have a revolt. Well, now they love it. Why? They have control over their patients. They can do some post-op rounds. So with physicians, as long as it's their idea, they start to feel better. They feel that they're disrupting stuff. We totally abdicated our responsibility with EMR, and then we were stuck with Epic and Cerner and Allscripts that really is not very patient-friendly or doctor-friendly.
You know, the recent announcement by Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and J.P. Morgan Chase to disrupt the healthcare system. This seems to be the beginning of an era of disruption. And I'm wondering how you see the future in terms of these new players and providers out there.
So, Mark, I think this is a big deal. This is a clarion call, not just to those three employers, but to other employers, that it's not fair to our employees that the thing that's most important to them, healthcare, is stuck in the 90s. The whole pharma thing is a mess. The largest payer in the country, CMS, cannot negotiate healthcare costs in pharma, and that Canadians spend one-fifth what we do for certain drugs. That, along with what Intermountain and Ascension have done, is said we're going to start our own generic companies and pharmacy benefit managers. That's a disruptor. The second thing is you have this thing called insurers that's 17 or 18 cents on the dollar, really middlemen. Mm-hmm. That are basically, so it's other people's money. So I think really what's happened is Jamie Dimon and Warren Buffett and Jeff Bezos are really smart folks. And they said, you know what? Government, we've given you enough time. Pharma, we've given you enough time. Providers, we've given you enough time. It's clear to us that you just don't get it. And we've transformed another of other industries, so now we're going to take it under our own clutches. So I think it's more than the 1.2 million employees. because I think you're going to see a lot more direct employer to provider to pharma entities.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Stephen Klasko, President and CEO of Thomas Jefferson University and Jefferson Health, and author of We Can Fix Healthcare. You can learn more about their work by going to jefferson.edu or follow him on Twitter at Klasko. Dr. Klasko, thank you for sharing your vision and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
It's been great talking to you, Margaret and Mark.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
The head of the House Science Committee made a false claim about funding of graduate students from the National Science Foundation. Representative Lamar Smith, chairman of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, said that the NSF funds, quote, more than twice as many graduate students in the social and behavioral sciences as in computer science, mathematics, or material science. In fact, 21.5% of the 22,821 graduate students were in math, computer science, and material engineering. That's more than three times the number of psychology and social science students. He claimed the NSF is funding too much low-priority research in the social and behavioral sciences and not enough research in, quote, fields most likely to yield scientific breakthroughs, technological innovation, and economic growth. Smith has a right to view some scientific fields as more important than others, but he's wrong about NSF funding for graduate students. His office urged us to reach out to NSF for specific numbers, so we did. An NSF spokesperson told us that Smith's statement only focuses on a single program and therefore is inaccurate. If we look at NSF funding for graduate students across the agency, NSF funded the most graduate students in the physical sciences, including physics and chemistry. Nearly 18% of the 22,821 graduate students with NSF funding. In second place was computer science. 14% of the students were in that field. When we add in math and statistics students and material engineering, 21.5% of the graduate students funded were in the fields Smith mentioned. Psychology and social science students, meanwhile, made up only 5.9%. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Of the 6.6 million births per year in this country, over half are unintended. And among teens, those rates are even higher. Colorado has been conducting an experiment for several years to examine what might happen if sexually active teens and poor women were offered the option of long-term birth control, such as IUDs or implants. The first question to answer, would they take the offer?
What was so striking was the word of mouth amongst these young women to each other and the network of support that was built to access this program through these clinics to help the tens of thousands of women over the course of the 4 to 5 years really did result in these significant decreases in unintended pregnancies and abortions.
Dr. Larry Wolk, medical director of the Colorado Department of Health and Environment.
The resultant decrease is 40% plus or minus in both categories, pregnancy and abortion, when you extend this out over an additional year, to more than 50, even approaching 60% reduction in those unintended pregnancies and abortions.
There was a significant economic benefit to the state as well.
We've seen a significant decrease in the number of young moms and kids applying for and needing public assistance. You know, we hope that then longer term, this will translate into better social and economic outcomes for these folks.
The incidence of sexually transmitted diseases dropped in this population as well.
And amongst young women 15 to 24, we've seen a decrease in sexually transmitted infections, and the rates are now below the national averages.
A free, long-term contraception program offered to at-risk teens and women trying to avoid the economic hardship of unplanned pregnancies, leading to a number of positive health and economic outcomes for all involved. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.